Good morning. We'll open the House Interim Task Force on Seniors this morning. This is October 4th, 2006, and we are short a couple members, but I think they'll be along. And we'd like to get started and get going. Our first item on the agenda this morning is the topic we were discussing earlier regarding seniors and people with disabilities and the swing bed issues, and then there are some other issues that have come up that we would like to have the agency talk to us a little about or explain a little about. So am I on track here,
certainly,
Sandy, or do you have some other things we need to say before we get started?
Just good morning and welcome, and we're raring to go.
Okay. I think we're starting off then with the update on the swing bed. Mr. Case will lead off. You're going to bring reinforcements in, Jim? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Senior and Disability Program at the Department of Human Services, and Elaine Young is with me, who heads up our licensing and certification for long-term care facilities. Based on the discussion several months ago, and then we had a follow-up sort of a subcommittee meeting in Portland around the whole issue of swing beds. And to refresh your memory, swing beds is a federally designated category that allows some use of hospital beds for either long-term care or post-hospitalization rehab. We've had a fairly restrictive policy in the state of Oregon limiting the number of beds in hospitals that can be used for that purposes to 5. And historically, and still in our rules, we say that if there is a nursing home available within 30 miles, that those nursing beds have to be used first before swing beds or any other long-term care setting would be utilized. So we were challenged to look at whether the department could take a more flexible approach on this, particularly in rural areas where there are either no nursing facilities or limited nursing facility capacity, and what we could do by rule as opposed to what would require a statute change. And so we looked at all those alternatives, and we put together a brief profile of all the critical access hospitals in Oregon. And essentially there are two areas in Oregon that do not have nursing facilities within 30 miles and for whom, you know, the more extensive use of swing beds appears to be completely appropriate. So what we're going to propose, if the committee is in support, is that we would pull together pretty quickly a rule group, and we would move towards new rule language that would allow a facility in an area that does not have nursing facility capacity up to 20 swing beds. The maximum under federal law is 25. We would propose 20 because under the public health section that's responsible for hospital licensing, they still believe that you have to have at least 5 hospital beds or twice the average daily census for acute care capacity, still reserved exclusively for hospital use. And the overall statute that requires for hospitals says that hospitals have to be available for primary acute care. So we would say either 5 beds or double the normal acute care capacity, whichever is the greater. And then that minus the 25 would make up the number of swing beds that could be available to be used in that setting. So it could be 20, it could be less, depending on what the normal acute care capacity would be. We had some discussion on how the department would view inspections, licensing, and all that. These are still hospital beds. They would be licensed by public health. We on the long-term care side would work jointly with the licensing section under public health to look at long-term care that's being utilized in those settings. So we would work out a joint arrangement with public health to do that. We also, there's been some concern expressing, well, what if nursing facilities that exist within that 30-mile radius are full? Could we have some sort of excess swing bed capacity available in hospitals? It has not been, based on everything we've looked at, there always appears to be adequate capacity. If that circumstance arises, we could certainly do immediate and temporary variances, because, again, we don't want people to have to travel long distances for their long-term care needs. But again, maintaining that sort of appropriate balance between long-term care and acute care, even in rural areas, we think is important. So that's our proposal, and again, if that's your consensus, then we would pull folks together and we would begin drafting language pretty quickly to amend existing rules to create these additional options.
Questions from the members? See, I guess it was Representative Nolan and I that were at the second meeting or subcommittee or sub-meeting, whatever terminology we're going to use with it. So, and what we're hearing today, I think, is an outcome of that, plus the hearing that we had previously. You've addressed a couple of the points, Jim, that I was, I think, concerned about. Just clarifying and having on the record that in terms of if there's no room in the inn, that the department be willing to come up with some temporary variance or temporary suspension of rules, then to allow so that people don't have to go 100 miles from home. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we would build that right into the rule.
Okay. I would really appreciate that. I guess one of the other questions I had is, what kind of a time element are you looking at for the rules to be, for you to be able to draft the rules and to be able to implement the rules, have the appropriate hearings, etc., so that they can become adopted?
Mr. Chairman, I think we're probably talking 2 to 3 months, assuming, because typically we pull together a rule group, so we would pull together the affected parties, the stakeholders, to be part of that, to look at actual language drafts, and we usually do that even before we hold hearings, so we would want to do that, achieve consensus, and then the hearings probably would be pretty perfunctory, but I think within 2 to 3 months we can have a final rule.
So the chair would be safe in assuming that well before the end of the next legislative session that this would be in place in rule form, is that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and we can keep you apprised of those timelines and in our progress.
I would like to thank the department and the folks there working on this issue. I realize and recognize it's a very small N we're talking about. I knew that when the topic came up, you know, to begin with. But unfortunately, for the people affected, whether it's a small N or a large N, the people affected are still the ones that I believe the department as well as the legislature is responsible to enable and to provide them with the best, you know, that we're able to do. This, for a couple of those cases, then at least will provide some relief and some additional opportunity for people to stay closer to home if that's their choice. We're very grateful for your work on this and appreciate the efforts that you put into it. And we'll look forward to kind of putting this thing to rest and moving on with other topics.
Thank you.
So if there are no other comments, we'll proceed. I think we've got some other areas here. What are we looking at, Sandy? Review of the residential care facilities, the assisted living licensing inspections, and let's see. you'd be...
Turn that over to Ms. Young.
Okay.
Yes, I'm Elaine Young, and the program manager for licensing and the inspections for licensed care facilities. So, I think I'll just do a brief overview of our work activity in that area. Assisted living and residential care are licensed to provide care for six or more residents. Now, six would be a fairly small residential care facility. They usually are more in the realm of 50 to 60 bed capacity. The residents in those care facilities are elders and persons with disabilities, needing assistance with activities of daily living and management of chronic disease processes such as adequate medication, administration and management, some overview of change of condition and the care facility reacting to change of condition and getting appropriate care and treatment to those folks. About 70% of these facilities accept Medicaid payment for residents that are our clients. And those folks, if they were not living in those care settings and able to utilize Medicaid for their care services, would be living in nursing facilities. Now, state law requires that these facilities be licensed every 2 years and periodically inspected. And it is, we feel, essential and good public policy that would dictate that those inspections, that we also we be out there and inspecting those facilities prior to renewing a license because of the vulnerable population that's served in these care facilities. The number of assisted living and residential care facilities is now 427 in our state, and that's about a 62% increase over the last 8 years. The department was approved about 8 years ago for three specific FTE staff for the inspection of these care facilities. We had no other approval for staff specific to assisted living and residential care inspections other than these three FTE. But we certainly understand our responsibilities, and over the last several years, because of the growth in this industry, we have actually deployed seven of our nursing facility inspectors to join those three to form a team of 10 to try to keep on top of our inspections. Even so, we've been unable to keep up with licensing inspections every 2 years. Now we have 25% of the facilities that have gone in excess of 2 years from having had a visit from our state inspectors. And we have another 15% of our facilities for a total of 40% that have had a survey interval greater than 18 months. We do deploy our survey staff based on risk. We respond to complaints that indicate systemic issues in facilities. We hear about those complaints from the public and from our local adult protective service staff. We follow up with facilities that have identified noncompliance. So we think it's absolutely important that when we do go in for an inspection and we evidence noncompliance and issue a survey report, we have an expectation that a plan of correction be written, and there's a need to go back and validate whether those corrective actions have been implemented. It does nobody any kind of service to identify problems and never follow up to see if they've been corrected. So that's another one of our priorities. And then we do more frequent inspections of facilities that have been identified with chronic noncompliance. An example would be a facility where we had found many systemic issues leading up to, say, maybe the main issue was a lack of or not adequate staffing. So we may have put a condition on their license requiring a certain level of staffing. We then could go back for a revisit, find that the facility's back in compliance, but concerned because of their past history, can they sustain that compliance? So we also have a policy that 6 months after we've been in there with a license condition, we'll go back for another full survey to see if indeed they have maintained that compliance and we're not getting on this kind of seesaw of noncompliance. So we work very diligently with facilities identified with problems to be giving them our attention. Unfortunately, there are many facilities that we don't hear about, and those are the facilities that have these long survey intervals. And also, unfortunately, when we do go in for those inspections, we don't necessarily find that all is well within those facilities, even though we haven't had any complaints about them. So now, as we have been I guess the best way to say is sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul, with protection as our main issue. So we've been utilizing our different survey staff to try to cover this. But we have now been faced through encouragement by the federal government, who has regulatory oversight of nursing facilities, to be taking a stronger role with our inspectors in investigating complaint investigations in nursing facilities. And we've had a tremendous increase in workload related to that mandate in order for us to maintain compliance with federal regulations. So we're at this point where, you know, we have 48 surveyors to cover the inspection of 427 assisted living and residential care and another 143 nursing facilities that we inspect also for the federal government. And quite frankly, the morale of our staff is getting low because they're running like crazy all over the state of Oregon. So we can no longer continue to deploy resources from nursing facilities to cover community-based care facility inspections. And toward that end, we are approaching the e-board in November, I believe, to ask for an additional 5 surveyors specifically for assisted living and residential care. So, may I answer any questions?
Representative Gerard.
Elaine, in a worst case scenario, what period of time are we talking about between inspections?
The worst case scenario we have is 40 months.
40 months.
40 months. We have an assisted living facility that has not had an inspection for 40 months.
Follow up? Any questions?
I do. Just a follow-up to yours.
That's fine.
Was that inspection precipitated by a complaint? Or is that just the normal?
Which is the
one that hadn't been done for 40 months?
It still hasn't been done.
Still
hasn't. We're at 40 months with that facility.
But did it start with a complaint?
Well, when I say 40 months, that was the last time we went in for a licensing inspection.
Oh, okay. All right.
Representative.
Thank you, ma'am.
Nelson.
Nice to see you, Mr. Chair, and all. Thank you for all you do. But what's the amount of money you're going to be asking for?
Well, do you want
to? Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I can't tell you exactly. I mean, I can get that number for you very quickly. We also have a policy option package that will refer for potential consideration in the governor's budget as well. So I can get that exact amount for you.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you very much. Without the exact amount, could you just give me a ballpark of both of them? Of issues.
5 FTEs, probably. $300,000, something like that.
And we fund those FTE 70% with Medicaid administration dollars, which is a 50-50 match, and 30% with general fund. And that percentage split is related to, how many facilities have Medicaid contracts. So Medicaid allows us to ask for reimbursement because this is basic health and safety inspections. So we can do that for the 70% of the facilities that participate in the Medicaid program.
Follow up.
Thank you for that answer. What is your budget right now?
The survey budget? The survey budget is about $10 million a biennium. Again, I can provide you with the exact budget figures.
Representative Gard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elder abuse is something that is just getting more and more public attention. What is the number one complaint against assisted living homes as you've gone through and responded to complaints?
Well, Representative Gerard, the number one complaint that we identify in assisted living and residential care is mismanagement of medications. That the medication administration system is not safe.
Follow. Each ALF is required to have one nurse on the staff, or what is the requirement there in regards to giving medications?
Well, The assisted living regulations, Representative Girard, do not require a specific number of hours of registered nursing on staff. The requirement is that you have a registered nurse that will provide oversight of the healthcare system. They don't provide hands-on nursing, and it can vary. There are some nursing. There are some facilities that they have to have enough staff of RN coverage to respond to expected or unexpected nursing needs. But I can't emphasize enough that they are not hands-on nurses, and the folks, we also do not require certified nursing assistants. They are lay caregivers in our assisted living, so the folks providing medication administration are trained with some rule requirements by the facility, and they are lay caregivers that are administering medications.
No, just... That's not a good answer, I guess. not your fault, but it shows a real lack of, if that's the number one problem, mm-hmm. What are we doing about it? Nothing.
Well, no, Representative Girard. We certainly, in collaboration with the provider industry, there is... medication administration training provided to staff and that sort of thing. Certainly the industry takes the issue very seriously and has been working with members to correct those issues and provide training and whatnot. Our rules do require that they have a pharmacist that oversees the medication system, but I can't deny that it's not. It still continues to be our number one issue is medication administration.
Follow. So I just want to. So the assisted living care home can hire someone off the street mm-hmm. with no medical background, put them through. I don't know whether the course is extensive or not, in regards to the training of mm-hmm. these people. And while you have administrative supervision of the dispensing of medical drugs, there's nobody watching patient A gets two of these, one of these, five of these, etc. In other words, they may put them in the cups, but after it leaves somewhere and goes to the patient, it is indeed, as you described, a lay person with right. no basic experience.
We do expect them to, and our rules set forth that they administer medications within a standard of practice, following the basic rites of medication administration. So you have a medication record that's specific as to the medications to be given by what route at what time to what person. There's the expectation that when you dose out that medication that you actually see that person and you make sure it is that person that gives it. And that's where, what we're identifying are problems where that system breaks down.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, if I could add, the interesting thing about Oregon is, unlike most states, we serve probably 80 to 85% of all long-term care clients in community-based settings as opposed to nursing homes. And in many states, the vast numbers of long-term care clients are served in nursing homes. So Oregon has historically, since the early 80s, sort of pushed the envelope on care provided either in people's own homes, in foster care, in group homes, assisted living, and that type of thing. We also have probably one of the most aggressive nurse delegation laws that actually allows nurses to delegate tasks and then to train lay people on different kind of nursing procedures and passing of meds and that type of thing. But we have lay care. It's not just in assisted living, in group homes, in foster care. In the home care program, we have lay people dispensing meds, handing out meds on a very regular basis. So the quality issue really becomes, the oversight of that, the training of that, the nurse delegation that goes with that. But along with that, you know, we face a tremendous nurse shortage. I think the average age of nurses in Oregon is like 47 or something like that. So how we're going to cover that vast array of community services over time is, and it's part of our planning process. But Oregon is out there and has been historically in supporting people in non-medical kinds of environments.
Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me, when we license one of these facilities, is one of the criteria a certification of X number of hours of training in a certain syllabus that addresses these complaints?
Well, Representative Nelson, Chairman Jensen, the rules set forth areas that the lay caregivers have to be trained in, and we're just completing a rule revision that will require a certain number of hours pre-training and then on-the-job training kinds of issues. I don't know if that answers your question. There isn't a set class, say, for 32 hours that somebody has to complete prior to working in an assisted living.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Is there any way, I'm just wondering, I want to know why there isn't a specific training requirement. And when I look at the number of complaints, I mean, we've doubled in complaints in 3 years, mm-hmm. according to our chart, and it would seem to me it would be critical that we would examine the training program and the certification of those who work to help our precious seniors and those with disabilities. Is there a reason why we have not done that?
Well, there is a cost issue associated with mandating a particular curriculum for a particular number of hours. So the state has identified content areas that have to be trained to for the lay caregivers by the administration of the facility. They're required to evidence to us what that training program looks like prior to licensing, and then it's evaluated. But it isn't mandated down to a particular curriculum for a particular number of hours.
Representative Boone.
And correct me if I'm missing something here. It seems like I, as a firefighter and first responder, I have to work under medical orders, mm-hmm. and I'm not allowed to dispense any medicine at all, not even insulin, glucose gel or anything, or anything, and unless I'm a basic EMT, which I'm not. So I'm just wondering, is there some sort of medical advisor that the owner is licensed under? Then that person would take that responsibility and then therefore either have their their employees take a training class or something like that?
No. The requirement is that there be a registered nurse. They have to have a contract with a registered nurse, and part of their duties is to oversee the healthcare system within that facility. But there is no certification process of any type, whether it be for the administrator, the lay caregivers, in an assisted living or a residential care facility.
Follow up. To be clear, so they do have a registered nurse who's in charge. That would, must she or he be on premises?
No.
But
they have to be. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was just going to say, do they assume responsibility and liability then?
Personal liability to their license.
You want to talk about nurse delegation?
Do you want me to help?
Yeah.
Bringing reinforcements.
Yeah, it's always a good idea.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Hannum, and I'm over the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care, and I work with Elaine and James. If you just look at state law, I think there's an important clarification here for you. There is a part of state law that has been on the books for many years that specifically says that certain types of facilities, and this includes corrections facilities, residential care, foster homes, can have non-nursing staff administer non-injectable medications. That's in state law. And that was done many years ago in order to facilitate just standard medication administration.
Excuse me. Just a minute. Non-injectable medication.
Right, right.
That would include
just
the
oral medication.
That would include the psychotropics?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So what in all of our licensed facilities, what we have are very specific requirements for process on how medication administration is supposed to be done. So, you know, you have doctor's orders. All medications have to have physician orders. You know, the dose, the timing, everything about the medication administration. Facilities have medication administration records where they literally, every time the medication is administered, they are documenting. It's actually not unsafe. That's sort of a double negative. But if the process is followed correctly, lay people can administer medications. So our concern is not that there are lay people doing it. It's to make sure that the process and their training by the facility is adequate so that they follow physician's orders, give it at the right time, document that they've done it, and so forth.
Is this process part of the survey work that's done? Is there a QA quality assurance type of document someplace that you prepare to deal with this?
Yes. Medication administration is carefully looked at through all the survey processes. We actually observe passing of medications. And so we're not only looking at whether the documentation is correct, but we're watching the people who do the medications, you know, dispense them or administer them and seeing that it's done correctly. And that's why when Elaine says that there's a lot of citations, we carefully watch that and, you know, want to pay attention to that.
Representative Gregg.
I just want to mention that Cindy and I have worked together. We had a facility in Klamath Falls with a problem, and her office and under her guidance cleaned the show up and got this facility running properly and safer and everything else. So I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank you and to
give you
the kudos.
And that's
kudos.
Also thanking Elaine, and you know, we're all a team here. So
you work very well, and you do a very good job.
So. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On these medications, and thank you for all you do, is there a, do they abide by a doctor, doctor's orders specifically, and then so the doctor would be responsible for a wrong dose?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the doctor prescribes for each individual resident the type of medication, the dosage, the time of delivery, the frequency of delivery. It is up to the facility to then follow those orders and properly administer it. And if there are any problems, get back to the doctor to make sure that the doctor can reevaluate. They also work with the pharmacy, and we rely on pharmacies, which is true in all long-term care, of course, to help deal with medication problems with the physician, because the pharmacies, that's their expertise. So they might be advising the physician as well if there's complications.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So in this program, is specific. Is there a certain period of time that passes before the doctor then reevaluates if this is the right medication and should continue or should be stopped when someone's blood pressure changes? It's my opinion that I've heard, I guess I should say, what I've heard is, you know, more of our clients have greater disabilities than ever before in history. So to me, this is becoming a very precarious situation.
Representative Nelson, committee members, I'm going to speak frankly to you here. I am retiring this year.
No,
that's not what I'm speaking for. But what I want to share with you is this has been my career for 33 years, and I have been part of, as James described, the early development of community-based care. I've been in charge of regulation for over 20 years for long-term care. I believe in our system wholeheartedly. I believe in these community-based care facilities, but I am concerned. These are lay providers. It's not that they should not be lay providers. I support lay providers. But I think we need regulations that specify as much as possible, trying to be cost conscious. That's always the problem. It's not that the providers don't want to do the right thing. Of course they do. We're all worried about what it costs to add more regulations, more specific training requirements. Everything has a dollar amount. So we're doing a massive rule revision at this time, the biggest one for a decade, actually. And we've worked closely with the provider associations, with advocates. It's been controversial many times. What we must do and what we have to do for protection is assure that providers understand what they have to do, that there are adequate standards in there, and that they do them.
That's right.
And you've got to have frequent enough inspection and response from regulatory oversight, which is not a heavy hand. It isn't a punishing hand. It's a hand that's out there to see what's going on. Many times we see providers who cannot self-evaluate their own system problems. Survey helps them do that. That's what survey does. So this, to me, is a very critical issue. And I am hopeful that through the department's policy package or whatever mechanism, we can get more support, because Oregon has as high an impairment in the community as any state in this country. That's nationally known. And we have much stronger regulations for nursing homes because of federal oversight. I'm not suggesting we need that strong of regulations, but I am suggesting we need to know what's going on, and we need to have a way to encourage facilities to fix it and to make sure that they're paying attention to business. Thank you for letting me have that little...
That's editorializing.
Yeah, that's a little editorial.
After 33 years, she deserved it.
Let me... other question, Mary?
No.
Let me go back and just kind of so that I understand... I do appreciate that Oregon has taken a leadership role in this country in relationship to the non-institutionalization of a variety of, you know, those in need, from the disabled to the elderly to the mentally ill. I mean, that's been a fairly strong message out of the state of Oregon for some considerable time. There are times that I have certainly, and I continue to question, whether we have put the resources we need into the community programs, in effect, maybe addressing some of the issues that we are talking about here this morning, you know. And I think when we go back in the history of this and look at it, I certainly think this excuse me for the term way I phrase this, but what I call deinstitutionalization of services into community services. I think that this really was undertaken with the very best interests of the patients or the clients involved in this. That there's in some ways nothing more insidious than an institutional type of care. Sometimes it may be the only option, and we understand that. But the other thing is that it's been terribly difficult, I think, at times to maintain the appropriations that some of us might have thought were necessary for carrying on these community-based programs. And therein maybe is a weakness, you know, to it. And I don't know. I think we play a delicate game of trying to balance this, and we are certainly indebted as a state to the variety of groups that represent the more fragile populations as they, you know, keep reporting back. And we've all sat on committees where, you know, these advocacy groups come in and make a very strong and compelling case, and we, you know, try to respond, you know, appropriately, I think, to them. And this leads me, I guess, to concern, or obviously, and I think the agency is aware of the chair's motivation for this particular topic being here. I mean, A, it's one that is of interest to me. B, it was one that the Oregonian picked up some months ago and ran an article on about the inadequate inspections in these facilities, as the Oregonian article portrayed it, and it was our intention to try to get, you know, then your input on this, so that we could have a little bit of understanding, you know, or further understanding of that. And I realize, you know, you're making probably again, in part out of the Oregonian article, the case to the e-board that you need some more staff to do the, not that you were not aware of this before, but it certainly provides you some motivation, at least it would me if I were in your, you know, position for it. But there is, of course, always a possibility that as the e-board looks at this situation, or the next legislative session looks at this situation, that the appropriate, or that the additional funding won't be there. And, you know, that's just kind of sometimes the world that we live in, you know. So, with that in mind, I'm wondering, is there, how, you know, how do we, is there some way that we can try to improve, you know, how the agency deals with this issue, even with no additional funding? And I'm not suggesting that the chair of this committee is going to go to the Ways and Means Committee or to the E-Board and say, you know, no additional funding. I'm talking strictly in the kind of hypothetical situation. And one of the things, I mean, you mentioned that, Elaine, I guess, that there's one facility out there someplace, which probably should remain anonymous for our purposes here, but someplace out there creeping around is one facility that hasn't seen an inspector in 40 months. And I think you've mentioned that you tend, once there's a report, you respond quickly, more quickly to the reports than where the, when the, there are no reports of abuse or neglect or, you know, whatever it may be. And I think most of us on the committee would concur that when you get a report, you're really obligated to respond very quickly to that. But you got some pool out here, and you have some in that you have either no bad history or no reports on, and they do come into a second tier of priorities, or as I would perceive what you were telling me. But out of that end, how do you treat them? How do you deal with, okay, we've got X number of FTE, we've got Y number of facilities, we've got Z number of those who are in top priority for inspection. How do you treat this other group A as far as whether they see inspections or whether they don't see inspections?
Well, Chairman Jensen, our supervisors of our survey offices have having been one myself, scheduling is probably the biggest nightmare around. But what they're doing is juggling. They predict out for 3 months based on how long the interval's been. So we try to get to, I would venture to say that this facility that's at 40 months is on the schedule to be surveyed probably sometime within the next couple of months, certainly. So they're looking at those with the longest interval and plugging those in. But what happens is, with all best intentions, you're going to go out to XYZ facility who hasn't had any kind of complaint history, isn't on what we would maybe call our radar screen for being problematic. They have kind of a long interval, and we want to get out there, but then when another facility, we start getting calls from Adult Protective Services that people are at risk, or there are indications that people are at risk, then we have to divert our resources over. So it's a constant juggling act. We are cognizant of those facilities that we haven't heard much about, that have these lengthy intervals, and we're trying to get those in on the schedule and whittling down. We start from the top, those with the biggest interval, and continue down the list. And then we have these other priorities. We've got to get back out when we've identified issues and problems to see if they've corrected those. We need to respond to systemic issues.
Okay, let me just make an assumption here that I am the proprietor of this XYZ that hasn't seen anybody for 40 months. Being a somewhat devious, conniving, Scrooge McDuck sort of character, I recognize that, it's been a long time since I've seen anybody. They're likely to have an inspector coming out here pretty soon. So I hurry up and, one or a few months, really clean up the act in XYZ. So that when an inspector comes around, everything is just, sparkling. Then as soon as the inspector is gone, we kind of go back to my own, make money for me at the risk and expense of my patients or clients that are there. I certainly don't want to accuse all of the people out there of being, in this business. I'm not implying that for personal gain, but it is the type that are that I think this group and that your staff would be most interested in identifying. Mm-hmm. The question I have is, why is not this last category that's not a priority, why isn't it just put on a random basis so that nobody anywhere can predict whether they will come up for an inspection? Methodologically, that would be the soundest way. If you can't do 100%, it'd be the soundest way to approach getting to 100% if no one knows whether their number will come up or whether it won't come up, and if they don't have any way to kind of hypothesize that they may not be on the chart. That was merely a suggestion I'm throwing out for the agency to think about, and I think you can look at the literature, and you all are familiar enough with statistical sort of things to recognize that that's probably the most accurate way that one might approach it. And that's merely a thought for you to think about, not pretending to be in a position to make recommendations.
Chairman Jensen, I do want to... I don't want it to go without saying that we do have our local offices and our local ombudsman that are our eyes and ears in facilities between inspections. So I think that even this facility that is at 40 months, it would be highly unlikely that they haven't had a visit by our local case managers. And we do maintain a very strong relationship with our local offices that if they see issues, they tell us about them. That's not 100%. By all means.
I appreciate it's probably a very sterling,
I hope so.
but we do know that we miss some somewhere along the way. And my only thing is to try to, if we can't have the whole pie, how do we get the best use for the people, not for us, for them, of the pie that we do have to spend on it.
So. Well, I appreciate your recommendation. It's something that I hadn't really thought about. That kind of methodology has been used in non-long-term care surveying of acute care hospitals and whatnot for some time. So certainly we can talk with our counterparts at Public Health and see how they think that really works in terms of protection and safety of residents.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. Could y'all give me three figures? Number of facilities we have, number of clients, and the number of employees. I'd just like to know that caseload.
We have 427 assisted living and residential care facilities. And we have 143 nursing facilities.
Foster care homes. I think we're at about 1,800, maybe 1,750 approximately, licensed adult foster homes, commercial, for the general public.
Now, foster homes are licensed and inspected at the local level. And the assisted living, the residential care, which is the 427, and the nursing facilities, which is the 143, inspected by the state. We have 48 inspectors.
And how many clients?
I don't think we have that with us, but we can get that to you real.
I think that's a very critical number as we go forward.
Representative Nelson, we do need to, it's important to note, though, that Medicaid is just a purchaser in these facilities. For the senior population, we're just having a contract with a private business, many of which are all private. So there is a mix in these facilities. Some may have a lot of Medicaid clients, some may have just a few, some may not engage. So there's two figures. One is how many people are in these facilities, and then of that figure, how many are Medicaid clients. And
that would be great to know.
We will get you both of that.
Representative Nelson, I can tell you that we license about 34,500 beds across those three care settings.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, and may I have a clarification, and that includes the swing bed?
No, it does not.
Okay, I think we've ridden this pony far enough this morning, and I think you've given us some good information, and I would like to thank you for the information. I appreciate the difficulty of the task, and good luck when you get to the e-board with the... that's no reflection on the e-board or anything. It's merely,
Mr. Chairman, let me clarify. I'm not sure what actually is going to the emergency board. We're just putting that all together now, and we're not asking for new dollars. We're just trying to rebalance within the department.
Okay. With that, then, can we move on and review of the department's long-range planning and...
I'm signaling to Mike. He's got a handle.
Oh.
Be careful on your signal. I get.
I just jump up and they have to do something.
Right, 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 right.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Chairman, let me start.
Please.
I'll be very brief, but the department has been involved for the last 18 months in developing a long-range plan for seniors and people with disabilities, and this actually sort of dovetails into the conversations that we just had. The governor made a charge to us to really look at the aging demographics, the effect that's going to have on Oregon, from many vantage points, including the type of services that people will need in the next 20 to 25 years. We assembled a rather large task force with 7 work groups that have been at work over the past 18 months. Earlier this spring, we went to most communities in the state and did public hearings with the initial draft report that you have in front of you. And this draft will be probably revised many times as the work groups continue to work. But I just want to highlight a couple things. If you look at a couple of the charts and graphs, if you look at page 2 of this report, that's a summary on the aging side of what the growth is going to be. The number of people over age 65 is almost going to double within the next 20 years. In fact, by the end of this decade, Oregon will be the 4th oldest state. And in that huge increase in the number of retirement age folks, one of the fastest growing subgroups are those over age 85. And that's an important factor because as you age, obviously, your potential need for long-term care services increases correspondingly. So when you look at the retirement cohort, you have to think about how hydraulically that plays out across that population in terms of their need. On page 3, there's been a lot of national studies conducted by various national institutes. And the good news is most seniors don't require long-term care or paid long-term care supports. Most seniors can either support themselves or have help from their families and friends and communities. And typically it's somewhere between 4% and 6% of the aging population that actually gets paid public care and support of some sort. And that factors out correspondingly in Oregon as well. If you look at page 6, we started doing projections based on the total growth of the population and then just what we expected of the percentage of that population that would require long-term care services. And on page 6, we started graphing out. Again, this is all based on census data and extrapolations of that, and so I'm sure there's room for error on both sides. But taking a reasonably cautious approach, we started projecting in each of the age groups the number of people just on the Medicaid side that we think will require care over the next 20 years. And you can see the fairly dramatic increases in each of those age cohorts. And then finally, on page 8 and 9, we simply started attaching costs to that. And what we did is we took the current population in paid public support, their ages, and the mix and match of services that they're in now, and the average cost of that, and then just roll that forward over the next 20 years. And so you can look at each of those intervals, how the costs begin to change and increase over that 20-year period. And then finally on page 9, just a little spike chart, is simply trending forward the expected cost increase over this 20-year period for long-term care just on the Medicaid side. This excludes private pay and private care, but just on the public paid Medicaid support. And this represents potential dollars in today's dollars. We haven't added inflation or anything else. It's just projecting today's cost forward, and you can see the rather sizable increase. We've done this, and then there's a separate, and I won't go through this, and I pulled it random, and it just happened to be the county of the chairperson, but we did a on each local community as well, and we can actually provide this to each of you, where we drilled down and we pulled different websites and census data and began to project what the population looks like now in each local community across the state, including each local city within a local region. Cross-compared that then, if you look, just for example, in Umatilla County, you can see the growth rate for Oregon overall versus just in Umatilla County. And you can see the growth rate, this little chart on the right-hand side here, talks about what is expected to be over that 20-year period, the growth rate of the general population, and then compared to that, the growth rate of the 8-plus-65 population. And again, you can see the dramatic increases over those periods. And then similarly, and I won't go through it on the other pages, we then try to project forward saying, what does that mean in terms of the actual number of people that will need paid long-term care supports? And we have also then, we have other attachments that actually compare that to actual service capacity, the number of acute care beds, nursing home beds, assisted living, and the other care settings in each local community. And you can then begin to see pretty dramatically that the capacity would have to double, in some cases triple, to accommodate the huge number of people that potentially will come into long-term care over the next 20 years. We did all this and started this conversation part out of sort of just the shock value, just to get everybody's attention. And there's a lot of media attention on the boomers and retirement ages, but we wanted to begin to drill this down to community level, because it's not only human services, the effect on the economy, on housing, on the workforce, all of this will begin to ripple forward, and city planners and county commissioners all will need to be involved in beginning to look at these demographics. Part of what we're doing in the long-range planning process is not saying, well, we simply need to figure out how we can ramp up twice as many services and the cost that's associated with that, but we're taking a different tack and saying, what can we do that will make a dramatic difference in helping individuals, families, and communities prepare strategies on the ground that will keep people healthy and safe in their own homes and avoid as much as possible the need for long-term care. So part of the work groups, and you'll see, and it's at a fairly high level throughout the draft of this report, is looking at helping people in terms of financing, long-term care insurance, reverse mortgages, any mechanism that people can use to actually help plan to participate in the costs of their long-term care. Most people, even the boomers in the sandwich generation, think long-term care is going to be paid by Medicare and Medicaid, and it's not. And in fact, most individuals to be eligible for Medicaid have to spend down and virtually impoverish themselves to be eligible for Medicaid. And very few people think about that, and very few people plan. The federal government, as part of its Deficit Reduction Act in the last session of Congress, has actually given us some tools, some real incentives, for example, in long-term care insurance, that says to a senior or someone in sort of the pre-boomer retirement age, that if you prepay, if you buy long-term insurance up to a limit of, say, $250,000, we will exempt you then on the Medicaid recovery side. So if you use all of your long-term care insurance, you exhaust it, you have to go on Medicaid, we will forgive you from recovery of your assets up to that equal amount, which is a real incentive if you want to plan for your kids or charities or things of that sort. Because Oregon actually leads the country, we're pretty aggressive about Medicaid recovery. After you die, we go after your assets and your house and whatever you have left to recover the cost of that. So we're trying to look at how we can build in some real incentives and really begin to publicize the need for pre-planning for the 55 and the 59-year-olds to say, I really need to pay attention because my costs won't simply be covered by some other sources. There's also lots of data about healthy aging, that even in later life, some minimal changes in exercise and diet can significantly avert chronic diseases and other things, which are often the precipitating event that gets a person into long-term care. Exercise around bone density that will prevent falls and injuries. And again, the research is rich with this. The problem is, how do you take this to scale? How do you go up to community? How do you look at retirement communities and really publicize that if you will become involved with us in some basic diet and exercise programs, we can really increase the quality of your life and prevent the potential need for long-term care or nursing home care. So we're trying to look at, and I think what our goal is by the time we're done, it's going to take a couple of years to get there, is to put together a community profile that would be a planning process to say these components, financial planning, healthy aging, different strategies, need to be in place. And we can actually map that out, give that template to communities, begin to plan themselves, and eventually look at some fund sources through grants or even in our own budget that says we support those activities that are outside of the paid long-term care. Because in many ways, in long-term care, we've simply become a Medicaid agency. We sit back, we wait till people come to us, then we pay for their care. But we've done very little in terms of public outreach. And really, we're beginning to say our mission has to change dramatically from just being a long-term care agency to providing supports to communities to support their own seniors and people with disabilities in a much more concentrated kind of way. This is a work in progress. I can't even tell you exactly where it's going to end, but I think we're gathering the data. This whole draft is short on disability-specific information. We have lots of demographic information on aging. We have little or poor information on how that demographic plays out specifically to disability groups. So we're putting a new group together with people with disabilities. We're bringing in some researchers, and we're trying to trend that as well. Because, of course, people with disabilities are part of the booming cohort as well. So anyway, it's a lot of fun. I mean, we're actually sort of looking forward to this. And it is alarming in some ways and scary. But nonetheless, we're looking at this as an opportunity to rethink how we in the public and the private sector really begin to work together to look at these strategies and really view it as a community and a local issue, not simply a state agency type of issue. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Bloom.
Thank you. That's great. That's the way we should be moving. And we should ratchet it down to the kids' level, too.
Is that a question?
It was a comment.
Thank you.
A statement.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. On the Chair Jensen chart, we'd like very much for Yamhill County.
Yes,
thank you. And I know we're using previous figures, which always makes me crazy. Anyway, on the second page, I just want to be sure I'm reading it right. If Chair Jensen has 62,513 under 65, and he's got another 9,000 over 65 in his county, mm-hmm. right? Am I aboard? Okay. So at 80% of those people needing care, that's 7,200, just rounding off to 9, 80% of those. 80% of the individuals, Chair Jensen, over 65, I thought I just heard that said a while ago, 80 to 85% will are taken care of elsewhere, some other way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, most, if you look back, I think you're referring to in this big report, if you look at page 3, from all the national studies looking at percent of seniors that need some type of assistance, about 80% will be able to support themselves or with their own families and probably won't need formal paid long-term care. And again, in terms of the over 65 population, it will actually require paid care. It usually fluctuates between 4 and 6%. So it's a much smaller percentage that that we project would actually come into pay long-term care.
Okay, follow up here. So, Jen, I'm just concerned about Umatilla County because if you look at the bottom chart on page 2, available, is that beds? Then available what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, some is beds, some is like physicians per 1,000, so, but the rest are not beds, are a number of facilities, and then, so the count is the number of facilities or the physicians per 100,000, available is the number of beds occupied are the number of beds within those facilities that are currently occupied.
So it is beds, thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You commented briefly on sources of Medicare recovery, various personal assets. Are those recovery efforts attenuated in any way, shape, or form if there's a surviving spouse?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I'm not the expert on Medicaid recovery, but yes, there are spousal orders, there are different accommodations for level of income and still living spouse, but I can't give you exactly those formulas, and but yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jim. You got the review of the SPD then, legislative conduct. Concept.
Jane Ellen, you have the legislative concept. Oh, it is. Okay, sorry.
But it appears to me, Chair Jensen, that you don't have enough physicians.
We'd be glad to have you recruit a few more for us if you would.
I'd be honored to work on that.
We'd take most any kind that you can find. Actually, we're probably better, more in need of veterinarians, and probably they'd be
for the aging cattle population.
Yeah, well, for the aging cougar population.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, we were asked to just go over the legislative concepts that we're working on that are in various states and being drafted by legislative council. So this is the list of potential bills that we'll be looking at. The nursing facility provider tax sunsets in the middle of the next biennium, so we'll be working with the industry to bring forward a repeal of that sunset, since much of the revenue to pay for the rates now is based on a provider tax. We've been working with Senator Morissette on adult foster homes. Historically, on the disability side, we allowed variances where if the person was capable, they could be at home for certain periods of time unattended by the foster care provider, and based on a rather strict reading of the statute and advice from the Attorney General, we said we can no longer provide those variances, that the foster home provider has to be there at all times when the client is home. So we'll propose legislation that would allow a specific variance of that under limited circumstances.
Excuse me, Jim, did you propose or oppose?
Propose.
Okay, thank you.
And then, Mr. Chairman, the Home Care Commission, which was created by Measure 99 in 1999, which set up the Home Care Commission to bargain collectively with a union on behalf of home care workers. Constitution creates it as an independent entity. The enabling legislation didn't go far enough, and so it's still hooked up in too many ways to the Department of Human Services, and so this will clearly create the Home Care Commission as an independent entity, as was envisioned in the Constitution. So we'll be bringing that forward. Based on legislation from last session that added kids with mental health needs to the Psych Security Review Board process, which means if they plead not guilty by reason of mental defect or insanity, there is a specific dispositional route that the juvenile court then has. It did not include children with developmental disabilities. We're now bringing forward legislation that would include children with developmental disabilities in that as well. The Oregon Long-Term Care Partnership Act is what I referenced a minute ago, using the incentives that the federal government has allowed us with long-term care insurance, where we can then exempt on the Medicaid recovery side any amount of prepaid care that a person has obtained through long-term care insurance, so we need to amend our Medicaid recovery statutes. And then finally, for the home care worker program, we support about 11,000 seniors and people with disabilities in their own homes with home care workers. We offer workers' compensation coverage, and technically they are the employees of the clients. And so for return to home work purposes, if there's an injury, they can only return, they can only return to that client's home. And this proposed legislation would allow the Home Care Commission to elect on behalf of all clients workers' comp coverage for home care workers. So if there's an injury, they could return to any client's home. We could reassign them to a different place. And obviously that cuts down on costs significantly if you can have an early return to work. So those are our legislative concepts at this point.
Thank you. Questions?
Excuse me, I just asked.
Thank you.
I didn't do that. Just a quick question.
Please, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, will you be adding something to correct the survey issue problem? But without, since we have no training requirements for these people, would that be something you'd also include in here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, in terms of the surveyors, that wouldn't come through legislation. It would be through a budget proposal, and we have made various recommendations in our budget. And then, as Cindy Hanna mentioned, we're working with the industry on changes to the rule, but there's a lot of discussions about the cost impact of that. But nonetheless, we're working on that through the administrative rule process, not through separate legislation.
Started to let you off the chair, but I want to interject one additional thing. In previous discussions we had in relationship to medication, giving of medication, and I understood non-injectables, and this obviously therefore excludes insulin, which is becoming, and somebody's shaking their head.
You want me to, she's the expert, want me to call her up here?
Well, it's striking me that insulin, or that diabetes is a problem that is growing at epidemic proportions in the United States, and that somehow or another, if we're going to have professional medical staff in some of these facilities to inject or take care of insulin injections for, we exclude these people from these facilities, or we impose an incredible cost on. And if you would like to come up and give me a quick sort of thing on this, I'm not making a proposal here. It just struck me that this.
Well, maybe I could clarify. Because,
okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. How there are.
For the record, again, please.
For the record, Cindy Hanna. Thank you. There are different types of medications. The oral medications can be administered, as I described to you, by lay caregivers. Any type of injectable medication is actually nursing practice. So it's under the Board of Nursing regulations for what registered nurses or licensed practical nurses do. In this state, we have a Nurse Delegation Act, which allows nurses to teach under strict protocol lay caregivers, anyone, any of us here, regardless of our background, could be taught by a nurse to do injectable medications. Now, insulin is taught all the time. That is the type of injectable that if folks cannot do it themselves, other people help them with it. That is under the Nurse Practice Act, under nurse delegation. So nurses are regulated on how they teach and what instructions they leave, and our licensing administrative rules require facilities to be sure that they follow the Nurse Practice Act. So the consulting nurses to the facility can teach caregivers under that to do insulin.
So it is possible for injectable to be. Okay. This was just a side issue that I had that came up. Thank you very much for your clarification. And thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Where are we at? Behind schedule. Overview of the Senior Corps programs, foster grandparents, senior companions, RSVP. And the committee will understand that the chair wrote the original grants for RSVP in his local community that you have already seen some demographics on. And let's see, Beth Fox, Patrick Robertson, and John Brenny.
We have one other guest with us, Mr. Chairman, if she could join us. We brought a real live foster grandparent.
All right.
Can we, is she coming forward, I hope?
Yes.
Mike's going to
get her a chair.
And your guest's name, please, John?
Yes, her name is Helen Smith, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Helen, we are pleased and proud to have you, come before us today.
And she is from Salem, too.
She is from Salem.
All right.
Okay. As a representative from outside of the districts of Salem, we still welcome you very much. Who is going to?
I think I'm going to
lead off. Thank you, John.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is John Brenny, and I'm from Pendleton, a town Bob knows well. And I'm the project director for the Foster Grandparents and Senior Companion Program in that area and in some other areas I'm going to tell you about. There are actually six foster grandparent projects and six senior companion projects in Oregon. And I am fortunate enough to manage one of the most widespread projects. Our territory includes Eastern Oregon, which is all the way from Ontario, Baker City, LaGrande, Pendleton, to Central Oregon, which is Bend, Lapine, Madras, and Prineville, and then the Northern Oregon coast, Representative Boone, which is, as you well know, Tillamook, Astoria, and St. Helens. So I have a lot of territory. We oversee about 105 foster grandparent volunteers and 35 senior companion volunteers, and I'm going to talk about what those guys do in just a minute. Our sponsor is St. Anthony Hospital in Pendleton, and we would like more doctors in Pendleton if we could get them, for sure. We have a grant from the Corporation for National Service, and all three of our programs, foster grandparents, senior companions, and RSVP, are called the Senior Corps. Those three programs make up the Senior Corps. So, statewide, foster grandparents serve as tutors and mentors to more than 9,200 people, and mostly young people, who have special needs. And senior companions serve about 1,800 homebound seniors and other adults, too. And we help them to maintain their independence in their own homes or wherever their living situation may be. The Corporation for National Service grants about $1.6 million yearly to these various projects for foster grandparents and about $800,000 for senior companions. another senior companion program, the RSVP Retired and Senior Volunteer Program that Beth is going to talk about, receives about $1 million from CNS each year. That's Corporation for National and Community Service, actually. Our volunteers for both foster grandparents and senior companions must be at least 60 years of age. They must meet an income guideline. They must be in reasonable health, and they must pass a background check. Foster grandparents and senior companion volunteers give from 15 to 40 hours per week, which is a lot of time. The minimum number is 15 hours a week, and primarily they're doing reading assistance under the supervision of what we call a volunteer station, which is usually a school district, or a Head Start program. The goal is to help youngsters with the greatest need to become independent readers by the end of the third grade. But we've also started moving into middle school a little bit and of preschool. So we're really kind of trying to cover the spectrum in terms of school. Foster grandparent volunteers receive several benefits. And those include, very importantly, a stipend of $2.65 per hour, which is tax-free and does not count as income. They're also usually given a lunch at the school they volunteer at. They're covered by insurance, which includes accident insurance. They're given an orientation and ongoing training, and we're also able to help with mileage reimbursement. So we try to give them all the supports they need to be effective volunteers in the schools where they're serving. Foster grandparent volunteers spend consistent time, and that's really important, with 8 to 10 students each day. And usually they do that in 20 to 30 minute segments, giving 2 to 2.5 hours weekly to the same students who have been identified as needing reading assistance. And generally we're trying to have these students get up to benchmark in reading, which is what we want to accomplish. The second program that I administer is the Senior Companion Program. And that provides volunteer opportunities to low-income older folks. They must meet the same guidelines as foster grandparents, but we are charged with serving older persons who have special needs. We primarily serve seniors who are lonely and isolated, those recently released from a hospital or nursing home, those with long-term illnesses, excuse me, and those who may have a drug or alcohol problem. Our goals include a strong emphasis in respite care, companionship, and limited in-home and personal care. The senior companion volunteer works through a community agency, like a senior center, an area agency on aging, or a health department, and they assist their clients really to be as independent as possible. A typical assignment for a senior companion might be to transport a client to the doctor, help a person contact family members, or to help someone do grocery shopping. Senior companion volunteers really become the eyes and ears of the volunteer agencies that they serve, and they do those things in home for their clients to keep that person as independent and as able to take care of themselves as possible. We believe our volunteers, both foster grandparents and senior companions, truly perform community service, essential community service to the people they serve. Thank you very much. And let me introduce Beth Fox. She's director of the Foster of Us RSVP program.
Chair Jensen and committee members, it really is an honor to be here with you today. I love getting the opportunity to talk to you folks because you are the people that can help us make a difference in the state. And I feel like with the RSVP, Retired and Senior Volunteer Programs, covering much of the state, we are answering many of the questions that were posed by our esteemed leader before us from SPD.
Thank you, Beth. For the record, your name.
My name is Beth Fox.
Thank you.
And I'm the program director of the Lynn Benton RSVP, which is in Albany Corvallis, but reaching out to Detroit Lakes and all the way down to Monroe and Harrisburg and LC. So we've got quite an area. I tell you, these counties in Oregon are huge. So it's fun to get to oversee programs like this. So of the 15 programs that are RSVPs in the state, we connect up with many different nonprofits. It's really up to the individual RSVP how they fit in that community. Our particular RSVP connects with 130 different nonprofits in our area where we have members that are part of RSVP. We have nearly 800 in our organization that help those organizations make a difference in the community. Whether they're delivering the Meals on Wheels, whether they're driving the transportation, and you're hearing about both of those things today and the needs that are out there, they're doing this out of the goodness of their heart at no cost to the community other than the administration that is required from our organizations. We're a great return on your investment. We, in our office, have about 2.25 FTE that's managing these 800 volunteers. We also have 6 internal programs that address issues like public safety. How many of you have heard of Medicare Part D? Well, 9 of us, 9 out of the 23 SHEBA programs in the state, Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance, are sponsored by RSVPs. We are really making a difference with our programs. And we are trying to meet those needs, not just among the seniors, but among the school-age children, by helping as smart tutors, mentors. We have volunteers that are helping through the YMCA. We have volunteers that are helping through things that maybe you weren't even aware of out there. We've got an organization called the Albanian Alps Institute that helps with literacy for kids in the area who have an Albanian origin, partly because we're in a university area, so we have people that are there from all over the world. It is an immense pleasure to get to work with people who are senior volunteers because they have the wisdom and the maturity to give back to the community in a big way. And so what we are hoping is that you'll learn more about us and that you'll see the difference that we're making in meeting the needs for a great return on the investment that the state has given. Now, RSVP, among our 3 programs, currently does receive some state funding. The other 2 programs do not. It's a small amount. We each receive about $7,000 per program, but it helps. And so we're very thankful for that. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to, I'm going to introduce Patrick Robertson to you, who's the director of a foster grandparent program.
Hi, my name is Patrick Robertson, and I'm the director of a foster grandparent program. Our program sponsor is Trillium Family Services that operates residential treatment centers for emotionally disturbed children in the Portland metropolitan area in eastern Oregon as well as in the Corvallis area. Children's Farm Home Waverly and the Perry Center are the more notable facilities that we have. But we have a woman here named Helen Smith. And Helen has been volunteering in the Salem area for the last 12 and a half years. She is currently at Brush College Elementary School, and she had a birthday yesterday. She just turned 84.
Happy birthday.
So I'd like to ask Helen to talk a little bit about her volunteer experience, and then maybe I talk a little bit more specifically about the design of our foster grandparent program.
Hi. The first thing I want to do is say that I know Mr. Gerard, but he probably doesn't know me. I've lived in Klamath Falls for 68 years, and he was very instrumental in community affairs. He was the radio announcer there and very active. And I hope you're representing Klamath Falls here in Salem as actively as you were involved in the workings of the community there.
Thank you for the very nice compliment.
And let me assure you that he is. And
he did a great job.
Yes. I'm sure he would.
We miss you in Klamath.
Oh, sure you do.
And for the record, your name?
Oh, Helen Smith.
Thank you.
Yes, I do work at Brush College School. I go 5 days a week, 5 hours.
Wow.
And currently I am working with 8 children. And our main objective is a heart program, which is help encourage a leader today. And so it is a reading program that I'm involved in. And I have students that are below grade level that need one-on-one. Some of them just need some TLC, and some of them need a lot more than that. But they're a delight. And speaking of my age, I'll tell you a story. This is what keeps me with foster grandparents. I had a little boy, and I was working with him, and he looked at me, and he said, "How old are you?" And I said, "Older than dirt." And he looked at me, and he said, "Well, how old are you?" And I said, "I'm 83. I hadn't had a birthday yet." And he said, "Oh, I would have thought you 90. So I said, "That's different," because I said, most people, when they see me and know my age, they say, "Well, you can't be 83. You're too active and too young looking." He said, "Oh." So we went back to reading, and right in the middle of it, he said, "You really do look like 90. And that's what keeps me there all the time. It's a wonderful program. I just can't say enough good things about foster grandparents. If I was not involved in it, I'd hate to think what I might be doing. And I really look forward to it, and I hope I can still do it for quite some time.
Until you're 90.
Much more?
That's fine.
Okay.
Thanks, Helen. So let me tell you a little bit about what the Trillium Family Services Foster Grandparent Program is like. John mentioned that we're in elementary schools and Head Start classrooms, Boys and Girls Clubs, many places like that. But we're also trying to focus on some other areas, and I'm always looking for unique opportunities for our foster grandparents. The one-on-one reading is really important, but we have children at McLaren and at Hillcrest and at the John Cerebou Detention Facility in Eugene, and we have foster grandparents in each one of those facilities working individually with kids. The focus on reading and academics is really the bridge to the child. A lot of my background is with the Head Start program and the pre-K program that's funded by the state. I used to be the director of the program in Lane County for 10 years. But the reason I mention it is I really believe strongly in a child's self-image. You know, we are what we think we are. And if we think we're winners, we tend to be winners. And if we think we're losers, we end up having all kinds of problems in our lives. So the reading and the math and the history and the lessons are all well and good, but that's our opportunity to connect with that child and to convince them that they are capable, competent people that have a future, that can contribute and give back to the community. That's really a big focus of our program. We just recently became the sponsor of the Mid-Willamette Project, so our service area consists of Lynn, Benton, Lane, Lincoln, Yamhill, Polk, and Marion counties. And we have about 139 volunteers. And the average volunteer is in their early 70s. And they spend, like Helen, around 25 hours a week helping kids. And we have a monthly in-service training. We just had one here in Salem last Friday. We had a psychologist come in from the Children's Farm Home to talk about boundary issues, to make sure that we know what's appropriate in terms of interacting with kids and the slippery slope and all those kind of things that they talk about. And we touch about well over 4,000 children in terms of having an impact. And what I hear a lot from the volunteers is how wonderful it is to be in the grocery store and look down and all of a sudden there's a little child hugging their leg saying, "Hi, Grandma Helen, and so good to see you," and that kind of thing. Because they think we live in schools as they think teachers live in schools and there isn't anything else going on. The benefit of the program is not only for that child or that particular school, relieving some of the pressures on the teacher when the classroom size is built and that kind of thing. But what it does, you know, originally the program started in 1965 under the Johnson administration, and it's a national program, but it was an anti-poverty program at the time. To be eligible, as John said, you need to be over 60 or better, as I say, and on a limited income. And the income level is $1,020 a month for a single person. And I'm not sure if that's 125 or 125% of poverty. But what it does is gets that older person reconnected with their community. You know, we are what we do often. You know, we think of ourselves as, you know, a state representative, which is a wonderful thing, as the director of a foster grandparent, which is a wonderful thing, a program, which is great, and I really appreciate that. But when you retire, sometimes you don't have that identity. I used to be a nurse, I used to be a teacher, I used to be a whatever, but today I watch the soap operas and I make afghans and I sit and I don't exercise. That's been the case for a lot of the foster grandparents. There was a study done, oh, now I'm blanking on who did it, but anyways, they said, John Hopkins, I think, they said that if you're active, you live longer, and you're happier. And Helen's 84, and she looks like she's 64, and doing well. And I really believe that that's the case. People are active intellectually. They're connected emotionally to the children. They're out and about. They're up and down, walking the halls, and interacting with professionals, the teaching staff. Helen didn't mention she got this great card and a lot of recognition. Not just, we have annual recognition events. We have one coming up, I think it's the 14th here in Salem, where we ask people to come in and speak and thank the volunteers officially, but there's a daily pat on the back that comes not just from the children but from the principal, from the teachers that we're interacting with. And this is huge, you know. I mean, what's true of the children feeling good about who they are is true about me and true about our volunteers. We like to know that what we're doing is important and that it's appreciated. It's a very big deal. A sense of community kind of happens. Let me bore you, or not bore you, let me tell you a little bit about Robbie. Robbie Evans was a foster grandparent who passed away a week ago last Saturday from pancreatic cancer. She's an artist, and we had note cards made up, and I brought some for you. And Robbie was volunteering at the Wilson Elementary School in Corvallis, and the principal, Jerry Kasanovic, had the kids make a huge, you know, one of those trifold top, tabletop display things. He had the kids all sign that and, you know, "Get well soon, Robbie, Grandma Robbie," and all that. And at her memorial service, there was a very small gathering of people. 90% of them were teachers from that elementary school. They really related to her. They really cared about her. They were there to pay their respects to her and her family. And they had, and the daughter, Robbie's daughter, had this big monster card set up in the park in the Rose Garden so everybody could see. She also had framed, Robbie'd been in the program for 7 years, and she had framed all these pins that she had received over the years. Her annual, we have a 1 year pin, and it's, you know. And Robbie gave 4,800 and something hours to her community and to the children in their community. So I guess what I'm saying is that we make a big difference in the lives of children. But we also make a big difference in the lives of older people. And we help the educational system a terrific amount. Right now, we're trying to focus our program on children of incarcerated parents. If kids have had their parents in jail or have experienced the arrest and that kind of thing, we're really trying to identify those children and really make sure that they understand that they do have value, they have options, and those kind of things. We're also focusing on children in foster care. As you know, the life of a foster child isn't all that bright. Many of the kids go from foster home to foster home and have that feeling of rejection every time a foster parent says, oh, you're welcome in my home and you'll be here until you're 18, and then something happens and the child is moved to another foster home. So we're really trying to focus on those children. We have a pre-placement training, and I'm not sure if John mentioned that. Each of the foster grandparents goes through an orientation experience where we talk about confidentiality, and we do a criminal background check on everybody. We talk about the role of the foster grandparent. And one of the things we don't do is discipline children. We do a bit of redirecting and ignoring negative behaviors, but we're really not there to discipline the children. We're there to identify the positives and point those out to the kids. So I have a few cards that I'd like to share with you, and I did bring one of our brochures, and on the brochure, the photograph is my daughter, Jenna Robertson Witt. She's about 8 or 10 in this photograph. And Jenny Scott is a foster grandparent who just turned 89 in the program, and she spends 20 hours a week at Wilson Elementary and was one of Robbie's best friends, and the program brought those two women together. And I think that's another thing that the program does, is really increases the social circle of the volunteer and helps them realize that they're still an important part of our community. So anyways, I'll maybe give it to the fellow over there.
You mentioned that we'd like to have more men. I forgot that.
When we were talking earlier. Thank you very much. When Helen and I were talking earlier today, she said, I really want to mention that there's not enough men involved, and that's true. That's a very true thing. Out of the 139 volunteers we have, we did a quick check, and we had 13 men in those seven counties that are involved. So we're trying to find opportunities that really address the male ego, I guess, is the thing. But at any rate, we'd be happy to answer any questions. And we really, really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
I have one brief, quick question. What do you want from the legislature?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we would like to expand our program at some point, so it is possible that we would be coming back to the legislature and asking for some consideration in that regard. We haven't really formulated a lot of ideas around that yet, but we would like to expand the program. We do believe there are a lot of unserved foster grandparents, senior companion volunteers who could be in our program. Because our grants really are quite limited in terms of the whole areas that we serve. So we very likely might be coming back to the legislature and asking for some funding opportunities.
May I address that question also? Beth Fox, and so chair and committee, one of the interesting things, and I noticed, I think maybe it was Representative Boone that made the comment, and let's not forget the children too when Mr. Tay was presenting, and this is not to complain, but one thing I've realized, I've been working with seniors for 6 years, and there is a dearth of funding for the senior community. The seniors tend to be the group that's left out, and among the charitable foundations in our nation, many of them do not fund senior programs. I've been a very good grant writer and successful with most of the organizations I approach, but many of them won't touch senior issues. And with this tsunami of boomers coming up, we've got to start looking at that. There's 77 million people coming out of the next generation that are aging, turning 60 this year. And I agree, we need to start preparing for that and thinking about that. And how can we play a role? Because I really believe these three programs represented here today are very efficient with the funding dollars that we receive, because we rely on volunteers to help us make the difference in the community.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just begin by saying that one of the nicest things that one of my staffers ever says about someone is to tell them that they're a great American. And you have to do something very special in order for him to tell you that. And I just want to say that I think each and every one of you are great Oregonians and great Americans, and thank you for the work that you do for our state. I have heard, and this may be a little bit off target on today's subject, but I've heard from several of my constituents that they're having trouble as Medicare patients finding doctors to treat them. And I'm wondering if any of you have experienced or heard of similar stories. And if so, do you think this is a large problem, and is it more of a problem in certain geographic areas of the state? Or I'm just trying to get my arms around what I'm feeling to be a problem that may need to be addressed.
Probably my area, since we have the SHEBA program, and I do get feedback through the volunteers. We have 36 SHEBA volunteers that regularly meet with people. They helped through our assistance address some of those issues, helping 3,000 people with their Part D in the last year. And so they would hear anecdotally some stories of people that had moved into the area, and I would say particularly in the rural areas where we are. Many of the doctors are part of the Samaritan Health Services organization, and they tend to do a very good job accepting new Medicare clients. Some of the other smaller rural clinics cannot afford to have too many Medicare clients because of the contracts that the government has in Medicare and how much they pay on the dollar. It tends to be about 60 cents on the dollar, last I heard. And so they have to look at what they can afford to do. So I understand that the rural areas are the hardest hit.
Representative Witt, let me respond to say that in the Pendleton area, and Representative Vinson, I'm sure you know this too, a lot of lower-income seniors have great difficulty in finding doctors, and if they only have the Medicare assignment, it's doubly a problem. So it's something, if you're going to be looking into that, sir, I think that's tremendous. So,
Representative Johnson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think y'all are awesome. Thank you so much for all you do, and the artwork is fabulous. Really great. Ms. Smith, you're just a great role model. Thank you. Mr. Robinson, you mentioned this program that combines more than one county.
Yes.
That you're now heading in. What did you call that?
Trillium Family Services is a sponsor. Our on the brochure, there's a little bit about the history of Trillium. And Trillium is dedicated to helping children and making families stronger. And we became the sponsor for Linn and Benton County in 98. We added Lane County in 2002. And last October, we became the sponsor for the Mid-Willamette Valley Program, Lincoln, Yamhill, Marion, and Polk.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. I've been fortunate to work with Trillium in doing charity auctions, those horses.
Oh, sure, sure.
And I just think
Diamond and Diamond.
Yes, I'm just proud to do that. And I think it's a wonderful program. But is that the reason, I mean, what do you call this group? Is this for children that are sent to Trillium?
No, we're placed, we have, let me see, we probably have about six people on the Children's Farm Home campus, and that's where the horse program is and all of that, and they work in the cottages and as mentors with the children there. But the other 330 or 130 volunteers are placed in the community, in schools or in Head Start classrooms at Hillcrest, McLaren, those kind of places as well.
Thank you. Trillium, I just wanted to understand that Trillium funds it all?
No, we're required, we receive federal dollars to operate the program, and there's a 10% match. And Trillium helps with that match. We receive telephone, office space, those kind of things free from Trillium to meet that 10% match requirement.
Patrick, name is Brad.
Helen, did you live out in Bonanza?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a different Smith.
Okay.
You might have known my husband, Lyle Smith. He was county surveyor and director of public works.
Very good. Thank you for your earlier kind words. my question is for John. Actually, I should say Patrick. If we wanted to get a program similar to Trillium's in Southern Oregon, how would we go about it?
Now, in terms of, I'm not sure what...
The foster grandfather program.
Well, there is a grandparent program that serves Jackson, Josephine, and part of Klamath. And it's operated by a retirement center, isn't it?
Rogue Valley Manor.
Oh, we in Klamath love it when Medford runs something in Klamath.
I understand what you're saying. But there is, and I'm not sure how big it is or how many.
Because I've never even heard of it.
It's really difficult to get the word out. I mean, we do a lot of different activities, but still, it's really hard to, you know, get it so everyone knows of us.
Representative, I might just add, we have three volunteers in Bly, which is in Klamath County, that we administer out of Pendleton, and we have one lady who lives in Lakeview, who is one of our foster grandparents. So we are covering a little bit of your territory.
If you've got some needs, let me know, and I'll bug him.
Well, Bly happened to be the area where Al-Qaeda was going to open up a training ground, so I'm quite sure that the program would be very welcome in Bly.
The Gearhart School is happy to have the foster grandparents.
Yes, you bet. Thank you.
Bob, if I could just add one other thing. I want to make sure it's clear that each of our programs, see, is required to have a community sponsor. So, for example, St. Anthony Hospital in Pendleton is our sponsor, and they do a number of things as a hospital, but they're kind enough to take on the administrative detail of helping me run this program. And the same thing is true with Patrick. Trillium does a lot of tremendous things in the community, but they have been kind enough to take on the responsibility to be the sponsor. So each of these programs has a community sponsor, because we really want to be part of the community.
And shall I complicate things just a little bit more, Chair Jensen and committee members? The RSVPs are really different from the foster grandparent and senior companion in that our volunteers are not necessarily limited income. They could be. They could be, I've got a retired pharmacist that's helping with the SHIBA program. What a gift that is. We've got people in all ranges of social economic. We are, our volunteers are not stipended. We locally are sponsored by the community college, but we'll be looking for a new sponsor because of lack of funding. They are releasing our program. Even though we are fully self-supporting, they do provide us with space. We have a different match requirement. We're a 70-30 match, but it's up to the local organization. Some of us are 60-40. It's that minimum 70-30 local match. And really, we have a lot more freedom to decide the direction of our programs than these two. These two programs are pretty well defined by federal guidelines. Many of us have volunteer centers. We started a volunteer center back in 2001 because we were finding, even though we're with the retired and senior volunteer programs, we'd have a sixth grader call us and say, my teacher wants me to do a community service project and it's due day after tomorrow. What can I do? And we'd always say, come on over. We'll talk to you about that. And we'd find somebody in the community because that's what we do. We connect volunteers with the community. Same thing would happen with Boy Scout troops or being in a university town, sororities, fraternities. So the Volunteer Center is something that is a fairly new concept to Oregon, but there are more and more of us coming up. There's now 5 of us in Oregon, and 3 of us are associated with RSVPs. Actually, the 4th is in the same office with an RSVP. So it's kind of a natural mix to have that Volunteer Center. And the good news is that young people, and I'm talking grade school age up through probably middle school, are really interested in volunteering again. There seems to be this civic engagement desire again, and we couldn't be more excited to see that happening with the young people. Thank you.
Okay. I just want to say thank you, too, for what you do, and just point out that this is the kind of connections that we talk about, we wished we'd have, you know, to help, you know, I don't know what the word would be, enhance, I guess, and enrich people's lives, and both at the young end and the older end, so. And I also wanted to say, in just recently, I've been made aware that some of the scholarship programs are requiring a pretty substantial community service volunteer component. And the kids are doing great on all the other pieces, and they're going, well, what do I do for this? So this is a natural for that. So thanks very much.
Is that short enough?
Thank you.
Good. Thank you
very much. Appreciate you coming, and thank you, John, for the long drive.
Yes. We had a late city council meeting last night, so I'm not really 100%.
I didn't mention that John serves a number of capacities in our fair city, one of which is on the city council. You've been there now for 16 years. Yeah. Thank you.
Great. And you're not 90, I know that.
No, I'm not 90, but I just wanted to say representatives, we have 10 foster grandparents in Tillamook, and we have 10 in Astoria.
Cool.
So,
all right.
Thank you.
I might have to call you and find out who they are.
Okay. With this, we have, we're a little behind, but pretty close here. An overview of Oregon's elderly and disabled transportation system. And we're very fortunate today that we have Kelsey here to represent one of the views instead of having an individual who is gallivanting around the country playing golf
Playing golf in St. Andrews again.
He's visiting his grandchildren in California.
Oh, okay.
But close.
As long as they go to the golf course, he's keeping them. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelsey Wilson, and I represent the Oregon Transit Association. I'm the executive secretary. In 1978, Oregon's 3 major public transit districts established the Oregon Transit Association as a nonprofit association. The purpose was to represent these districts at the state capitol. Today, the OTA has over 30 provider members, 10 associate members, and over 20 vendor members from all across the state and even the country. This is our largest membership thus far. We have expanded our purpose of the association to assist members in the development of efficient, safe, and convenient transportation services, techniques and methods, facilities, and equipment. But our primary goal still remains our work at the Capitol. We are here today to thank the legislators present and your many predecessors of the last 21 years for your support of one of Oregon's landmark pieces of legislation. There are 3 outstanding examples of Oregon legislative achievement: the Oregon Beach Bill, the Oregon Bottle Bill, and the Oregon Elderly and Disabled Transportation Bill. In our opinion, the Elderly and Disabled Transportation Bill is the most significant. It certainly affects the most Oregonians. I label these as legislative achievements because in each case, it was legislators such as you and not the governor who created the legislation. In fact, one governor even threatened to veto funding of the elderly and disabled transportation. In 1985, the Oregon legislature, led by the late Senator Glenn Otto and former Senator Jane Cease, created the Elderly and Handicapped Special Transportation Fund. This funded the new service with a 1-cent tax on tobacco products. In 1991, under the leadership of then-State Representative Margaret Carter and many others, an additional 1 cent was added. In 2003, many of you helped add additional funds from ODOT's identification cards. Additionally, your Ways and Means committees have added some other flexible federal funds. You need to know that elderly and disabled transportation is a statewide service available in all 36 counties. Providers range from small and large buses to taxicabs. The following 8-minute video will illustrate these services better than I can explain them. Former Oregon Transportation Commissioner John Russell produced this film. He did a great job, and the film drives home just the point we are trying to make about the importance of E&D transportation. You will also recognize a current commissioner and the former ODOT director.
Over double.
Yeah, I look.
It's Wednesday morning in the eastern Oregon community of Pathway.
Where do we need to go today?
And Dave Mayhill is the most popular guy in town.
D&D.
Dave is a part-time driver for Community Connection of Baker County. On Wednesdays, he transports riders on what the locals call the senior bus. It's 50 miles from halfway to Baker City. Another 50 miles back. And each leg of the journey is an adventure.
In Eastern Oregon especially, it's a long road between communities, and in the wintertime, it's an exceptionally long road between communities. And so that one day a week they get on the bus to come to Baker is the epitome or the zenith of their life for that week.
Baker County has for many years been one of the higher percentages of seniors in population. Right now, we're looking at about 24% of those over 60, and I think we're about 19% and have been about that for people over 65.
Most of these individuals are senior citizens, and some of them are in their 90s. We try to make it comfortable for them, relaxed atmosphere for them, so they're not worried and they're not concerned about if they're going to make it to their appointment on time, or if they're going to be left, or how long they have to wait.
Hello. I use the bus most of the time when I'm coming out to the doctor. Mostly doctor's appointments. I have had reasonable doctor's appointments with my eyes. And I'm gradually getting a macular degeneration in my right eye, which I feel if it gets too much worse, I won't be able to drive.
In Oregon, right now, there's about 500,000 folks who are over the age of 65. We know them in the next 20 years or so, that number is going to over double. And a large portion, at least 25% of those people, cannot drive because of physical disabilities, vision, or other things. And therefore, their only way to get to a doctor's office, get to work, get to the grocery store is via public transit.
Ready to go, Dave?
Yeah, we're ready to get out.
Curry County is another area where distances between communities are long and critical services few and far between. So residents living along Highway 101 rely on the Coastal Express, which travels 110 miles from North Bend to Brookings four times a day.
Good morning.
74-year-old Bill Dooley is a regular on the Port Orford to Brookings leg.
I commute about 64 miles each way each day that I work down here, and I work down here 5 days a week in most instances. What have we found out on that 22 unit?
Bill manages Curry Public Transit, which consists of the Intercity Coastal Express and in-town on-demand vehicles. Both services run 6 days a week, and according to Bill, demand is high.
We are almost 50% population over 60 at the present time in the Brookings Harbor area. The total in the county, I have been told, runs between 35 and 40% population over the age of 60.
See you in a little while. Well, I rely on the bottle ride. They take me out to the beauty shop, and I call 2:30 to go home. And everybody knows that I ride it, so if I'm 5 minutes late or 10 minutes early, it's fine.
You got Bill, right?
I did get Bill, yes.
Our service allows them to continue to be independent far longer than they would be able to be if we were not in existence in the area. It's vitally important that these people be able to hang on, so to speak, to that independence as long as they can.
Wayne, this is exciting.
For Bob Bigman of Eugene, independence means the ability to get to work on time.
Bob is pretty miraculous young man for the difficulties that he has, I think. He's now 55 years old, so we have gone through 55 years of dealing with differences. Because he was a preemie, he had the cerebral palsy. And did take him in for physicals, of course, and was referred to an ophthalmologist. And I suppose that that was a very landmark and very, very good. I was told he was blind hard.
Today, Bob works at Oregon Research Institute. It's a job he loves and a job that benefits his community.
We've seen a transformation of Bob that's just been unbelievable. He likes to have fun. He likes to do a lot of things. And the Lane Transit District's opportunity of riding the bus has allowed him to do that.
They want to be meaningful and productive members of society. So without these services, it would be a sad day for the state of Oregon and a sad day for a number of residents.
If I didn't have the city bus, I'd be stuck at home.
With what?
Just playing with my CB radios.
It's all a big pile where you cut it into, you know, living, working, and social. And it takes transportation to do every single one of them.
I think they realize very quickly that, you know, a number of people in their immediate family probably need that type of assistance. Where family members and friends are unable to provide that service, that's where the public transit division and our programs step up to try to help. The main source of funds that's available for community transportation services are federal funds, which we can flex out of the highway appropriations, and those funds primarily are used for equipment acquisitions. We flex as much as we can. We work with the local districts to maximize our ability to stretch those funds as far as possible, but we never have enough.
It's more than tires, gasoline, or vehicle. It's a social support system that is just beautiful.
It just opens doors that we never would have imagined. And if we can make that happen for folks, all folks, not just folks with disabilities, then it would be a much better thing.
It's good stuff.
We are here today to show you how successful this E&D program has been, how it has grown quickly, and then what the near future prospects are. First, we need to recognize a basic demographic reality in Oregon's population. It's aging, and the baby boomer generation is retiring. As Bill Dooley of Curry County said in the film, Curry County's senior citizen population is growing faster than the rest of the population. This is the case in most of Oregon's smaller rural areas, and the case in our larger cities. I would like to introduce Julie Wilkie of Ride Connection, and she will describe her umbrella organization in the Tri-County area around Portland and tell you of their growth in service.
Good morning. My name is Julie Wilkie, and I'm with Ride Connection. I've been with Ride Connection for about 6 years. I'm currently the mobility manager. I started out in special needs transportation in the early 90s. My mom had just passed away from Alzheimer's. I had really seen how profoundly transportation affects people's quality of life, and I felt that I wanted to try and help out. I started as a volunteer driver for one of our service contract providers, and I realized then that transportation for older adults and people with disabilities really is as large a social issue as housing and food. The need for transportation crosses all ages and socioeconomic boundaries. It affects each one of us at some point in our life, whether it's a friend, a family member, or as a business owner, employees that have a friend or a family member and there's absenteeism. Without adequate transportation allowing us to be mobile, our lives are profoundly affected. Today, I'm here to share with you what we are doing in Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties to serve older adults and people with disabilities. Components of our program relate to every area of the state. So I'm really going to describe what Ride Connection does, but I'm here to represent all of us. While we serve the urban areas of Portland, we also have some rural communities as well. We are trying to provide service to as many people as possible, but we need your help. The 3 points that I would like to try and make today are, first of all, we are doing everything we can to be as efficient as possible. Second, our customers' transportation needs are growing faster than our capacity to serve them. And third, we really need your help to meet the transportation needs of our growing numbers of older adults in our communities and around the state. As we saw in the video and have heard others say today, you know, there's that how many individuals are turning 60 on a daily basis. Another statistic that kind of goes along with that is that some of us, almost most of us, will outlive our ability to drive by about 7 to 10 years. In addition to these folks turning 60, we have growing numbers of people surviving catastrophic accidents and illnesses who need transportation services. It is critical that we have transportation in place to serve them so they can remain independent citizens in our community rather than dependent on nursing homes. We are currently not able to meet the transportation needs of all of our citizens. We need your help to develop stable funding that will be able to accommodate this large influx of older adults as they age. Now is the time to lay that foundation of funding so that transportation will be available for them as they need it. Ride Connection is a 20-year nonprofit organization that coordinates several transportation services throughout the Portland metropolitan area. You have some information in your packet about Ride Connection and the services that we provide. We have a continuum of services that we provide, but just last fiscal year, we provided 358,700 rides to about 11,000 riders. We have community-based services, and right now our services are mainly provided by contracted service providers. We have 30 in the Tri-County area. The services that they provide are really based on the need of the community members. So it's door-to-door service for some, travel training for others, community shuttles or group shuttles to the grocery store for others. It's really based on that individual's ability level as to the services that are available and are provided for them. I wanted to tell you a story about a gentleman that I met last year. Don is a 76-year-old gentleman who lives in Forest Grove. He had recently gone in for a vision test because it was time for license renewal. He failed that vision test because he had recently developed cataracts. Though his wife still drives some places, they began to realize that soon they were going to be without transportation and wanted to explore their options. In Forest Grove, they had seen one of our buses driving around that has the phone number for our agency on it. So they called in. Our customer service representative talked to them about what the options are in Forest Grove, talked about the door-to-door service, how there is a community shuttle, as well as that TriNet, the public bus system, goes out to an area in Forest Grove. Well, Don decided, though, he hadn't ridden the bus since 1950. He was going to save the door-to-door service for when they got old, and he was going to try the bus. So he met with one of our travel trainers, he and his wife. They talked their neighbors into going with them that first time. They decided that they wanted to come into the Portland area, learn the Blue Line and the Red Line, because most of their doctors were at St. Vincent's. So they went on that first trip that day, and then their neighbor, unfortunately, had some complications from surgery. So Don gave us a call again and said, okay, Luis isn't going to be able to get on the public bus anymore to go to her appointments. Is there a way we can connect her to that volunteer door-to-door service you were talking about? So we did, and she had to have some procedures done over a course of a couple of months, and she wrote our door-to-door volunteer service program for that. So Don and Cherie, they say that they were out on the bus every day that first month, and they were so excited about it that one time they took the bus to, they belong to the Take Pounds Off Sensibly organization in Hillsborough, and they told all of the members at their Tops Club about this fabulous riding the bus program, and they convinced all of them to do a group trip on the bus. So they chose a destination in downtown Beaverton that served low-calorie meals, and they were able to ride the bus, the MAX, and then take a walk to the restaurant and back. And we, you know, Don chuckles about when he tells the story about none of them ever thought that they would be getting on the bus, but that they're all riding on a regular basis now. So that's just kind of one story of started out as one person but kind of turned into a smaller community that were provided with options for transportation. We are very efficient by coordinating existing community-based transportation to reduce duplication in service. We consolidate common oversight tasks like driver approval and training, vehicle acquisition, and oversight, just to name a few. As needs have changed, so have we. We have continually explored ways we can be more cost-effective and feel that we have extended ourselves as far as we can without additional assistance. For example, when someone calls in now for a grocery trip, for a door-to-door grocery trip, we really try and connect them with a shuttle that's already going in their area. So if they say, I really need to get to the grocery store, the Safeway, we say, wow, well, we have a grocery shuttle that goes on Tuesdays, every Tuesday to Safeway, and not only will you get to meet a whole community on the bus, but there'll be a concierge to help you with your grocery bags. This way, it's really filling or freeing up the individual trips to the most uncommon destination for those that need it. Also, we've increased the number of shuttles that we have in our area, which decreases the cost, overall cost of each trip. And even though our rural numbers have increased, which includes longer distance trips from far-reaching areas of our rural communities, our miles per trip average has actually decreased. And this really demonstrates our success in grouping rides. So if an individual says they need to go to the doctor and we have someone else going to the doctor in that area the same day, then we'll group those trips together, again, decreasing the cost per ride. So we're very proud to say that our average cost per trip for last fiscal year was $11.29. Ride Connection demonstrates an exemplary coordinated network of service options in the Tri-County area. Without Ride Connection system stability and reliability, citizens in our area would experience fragmented transportation services. Because we offered standardization and training, we build communication among our providers, and because we coordinate vehicles and funding, we maintain standards that keep our system consistent and strong. Increased support of programs like ours is an investment in reliable and coordinated transportation service throughout the state. It will allow us to serve a growing number of older adults and people with disabilities in our community. We want to work with you before and during the legislative session to create a funding package that will help carry us into these next 20 years of astronomical service increase needs. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for working on this issue, and I likewise served on a senior transportation board for my county, Yamhill County, and this week what I've been called about is needing funds for our veterans, because most of the drivers for our veterans have been World War II veterans, and they no longer can do it. So I'm just hoping that you're tracking that need in that area. Very important. Sorry, I have to leave right now. Chair.
Okay.
Yeah, now I would like to introduce Olivia Clark of TriMet to tell you how the growth of E&D services have changed in TriMet's overall service and their transportation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, Government Affairs Director for TriMet, and I hadn't heard what Julie was going to say today, so I'm going to piggyback on some of the comments that she made, because Ride Connection is a huge partner for TriMet in the metropolitan area. I don't know what we'd do without them. But not everybody can use Ride Connection. Some people do have to have a door-to-door Lyft ride that's provided by TriMet, and those are very, very expensive. Let me back up a minute and just tell you that TriMet provides we're approaching 100 million rides a year system-wide. 10% of those, we estimate, are elderly and disabled people, the kind of people that Julie was describing that can ride the bus or can ride the MAX, about 10%. That's terrific. But at the same time, we offer about 1 million rides a year door-to-door Lyft service, the kind of complimentary service that's required under the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's a very expensive service. And we do everything we can in working with Ride Connection to encourage people to use fixed route, to use the bus, to use the MAX, to find another way to get there if it's at all possible, whether it's a neighborhood shuttle, and we've done a lot of work building coalitions to create those shuttles in neighborhoods in different areas of the region. But not everybody can do that. We still have to provide that backup door-to-door service, which is over $20 a ride for TriMet, and we contract that out. And that's what we're concerned about. And as Julie said, we're doing everything we can to encourage people to use alternatives. But the demographic trend, you heard all about it this morning, we're really concerned about what that's going to mean to us in the long run. More and more people are going to need Lyft, despite our best efforts. And it's all about independence and productivity, and you heard all about that this morning. You saw the film. It's trying to keep people active and going out and being productive, and that's what we want to do. I talked to James on the way out. He's an old friend of mine. Now he's running this new combined agency with seniors and the disabled. And they did a series of field hearings, and he told me on his way out that they heard a lot of comments about transportation, that transportation is sort of the taken-for-granted service. And that he, in fact, because of all the comments he got from his field hearings, is going to be putting together a committee to look at adding that to his overall report and recommendations, which I'm very pleased about. But even though we have this growth, and we'll continue to do what we can, we project that if the elderly and disabled population grows on the Lyft service to the tune of 4%, which is very conservative, that's going to cost us another $11 million a year on top of what we already provide. There's no way that the state funds are going to keep up with that. At this point, they're not keeping up with inflation, and those are the funds that Kelsey and Julie talked about, the cigarette tax, the 2 cents that we received from the cigarette tax, as well as the ID card and some other funds that Flex Funds at ODOT comes up with. So we are here to thank you for the historic support. In fact, Oregon's really been a leader in elderly and disabled transportation. They were ahead of the game. We had a program in Oregon before the Americans with Disabilities Act was formed at the federal level, and we're very proud of that. But we're going to need some help during session, and we wanted to just bring that to your attention, knowing that you were going to talk about all the larger issues as well. This is an important one to not forget about. So thank you very much for letting us come here today to talk about this.
We're going to need some help in Pendleton, too. We want to high-speed rail from Portland to Pendleton.
150-mile-an-hour.
There you go.
And we need it from Klamath Falls to Portland.
We can probably connect to Portland.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. We're just now getting to Clackamas County with light rail. So give us a few more years and maybe we'll make it.
Well, look. We can't wait that long.
Mr. Chair, the statistics we have attached will show that the growth of elderly and disabled services have outstripped all the special transit program funds from both the federal and state governments. All our transit systems, especially the larger providers such as Lane Transit District, Salem-Kaiser Transit, TriMet, Basin Transit District of Klamath Falls, and Rogue Valley Transportation District, are struggling to subsidize E&D services from their general transportation budgets. It is important to realize that E&D services are expensive. The average cost per ride is over $20 per passenger with paid drivers, less where volunteer drivers are used. I've attached figures of some of the Oregon systems and also figures from the most recent national cost per ride data. Our members are developing programs to encourage seniors and disabled to use regular bus service, but we must consider regular bus service is not a viable alternative in many instances. In many of the rural parts of Oregon, there are no regular bus routes, and in places like Eugene, where Lane Transit has perfected one of the best alternative programs in the country to encourage regular bus systems, bus service, there are still those that don't have the ability to walk to the nearest bus stop. Simply stated, we, that is the OTA, Oregon Transit Association, and the Oregon Legislature, must address the successful program we have created and find additional revenue. We would request that you consider legislation to add an additional 3 cents to the tobacco tax and or explore other possible dedicated sources of revenue. Our providers are dedicated to elderly and disabled and pledge that if funds are increased, we too will increase local funds that we allocate towards elderly and disabled transportation programs. We would be happy to work with you and your very capable and experienced committee administrator to prepare such legislation. Let me close by again acknowledging your continued support for this popular program for our fellow Oregonians who vitally need these services. And please take a look at the attached information that helps demonstrate the need for additional funding of elderly and disabled transportation. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Representative Nolens.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And this is not so much a question as a comment to my colleagues on the committee and also to the people who presented this important program. Two things. I would caution my colleagues here and also on budget committees to be mindful that these services, by being effective and helping seniors, people with disabilities, and other people who need transportation to use fixed route and other efficient services, end up creating the somewhat counterintuitive result that the remaining people who can't use those services are indeed more expensive to transport. And so the success you have in getting people onto fixed route services, which are cheap and efficient, results in perhaps the unexpected result that their average cost per trip of the not fixed route goes up. And so I would caution us not to penalize these people for the success that they've achieved by looking at only one statistic. The second thing, and this is more to you all and the way you reach your customers and the partners that you work with. We've heard this morning and we've heard again here the changing demographics that Oregon is facing and also the disproportionate cost of serving that changing demographic group. More and more expensive services, people living longer, and in order to give them full lives, accessible lives, social lives, additional costs for those people in helping them. And what it calls to mind for me, we've had several suggestions that we need to, or we should be encouraged to look at that impact as we look at budgets. We may not be able to do the things you are asking us to do and some of our earlier witnesses asked us to do in supporting additional services if the voters hand us the Tabor ballot measure, because it affects every part of the state budget, including transportation, including non-general fund programs. And this presentation just makes it very clear that the simple increase in population, increase in standard inflation formula will cripple programs like this.
because as services get more expensive, because the group of our population that's increasing the fastest needs the most expensive services, that will be a noose around everybody's neck. And I hope, this is my request to you, that you are helping your customers understand that that ballot measure is a noose around the neck of the services that you're able to provide them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. As always, you're very thoughtful, analytical, understanding of some of the issues and how complex they may be. Appreciate that.
Age before beauty. I'm older than Bill, and you guys didn't know that, did you? And I wanted to just follow up on what Mary said is the same. I think it was this panel before you where the woman said that senior services are often the last thought of or the least funded. And that is exactly what it is, as I hadn't thought of that one. I keep a list of this just so that I know what it's going to affect, this measure 48 and 41. It's most 48, I guess, is the one. People don't realize it's not just it's on the spending, so it counts all spending, including federal dollars, matching everything. And so when you start adding those up, even though people think it's just the state spending, it's not. And if you go look at transportation and what's the other one that has a huge federal match, education and all those things, you would
Medicaid,
thank you. You would have to include all those dollars in the spending cap. So it's something that then would behoove us in that sense, if this did pass, to leave those federal dollars out of the mix.
And
then we would really be in a pickle.
I would appreciate the comments, but I would think we maybe are treading on dangerous ground. I think everyone understands.
We can't say vote no.
You can't.
That's what I said.
I wasn't going to go that far, but I was just pointing out the things to consider.
Understand.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I also want to say is in my the second part of my sentence, I am so glad to hear Julie's comments. Well, it's sort of, I guess.
Okay.
Well, I just sort of morph it into it. But I am, in our family recently, we've been faced with transportation issues with somebody in the Portland area, and I'm really happy to see that, because I really thought it was limited to the Fairless Square, and I don't know about the door-to-door. I know in the rural areas, in our area, we have door-to-door service, too, which we can only use in some cases. So I'm put a little note on your things to
great.
Hand
Give us
this
a call.
Over. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Brad.
Well, it's always nice to see Olivia again. My question's for Kelsey. Are most of your transportation districts funded through bond measures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I would have to go and kind of pull our transportation districts and gather a little bit of information. I don't know the answer to that question, but I would be more than happy to look into it and get back to you.
I would appreciate that very much.
Sure.
Yes, committee would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Tillamook, thank you. Tillamook has a funded one, but we also just got a piece of the Connect Oregon for a transportation system in Tillamook. So there are several different funders for that, and we were happy to get that down there.
Say cheese.
That's right. Cheese, trees, and ocean breeze. You started.
I opened it there. I didn't realize I did, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your being here. Appreciate the testimonies. And I'd like to share something with you, Kelsey.
We'll get a nice
letter from the chair. Yeah, we'll come down.
Thank you.
We have public comment.
Mm-hmm. Nobody signed up, sir.
And nobody signed up. Here comes a public comment. and we will, but you're happy.
It's the silent public.
And we will have no work session today, so at this particular point then, we are adjourned.